Great. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Tanasi. How are
I'm
you?
good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It's a nice day here in New York.
Well, it's a nice day here in Beirut too. A little rainy, but
That's
Beirut to Brooklyn, right?
yeah, exactly. Beirut to Brooklyn.
So, you read The Insurgents by Fred
Well,
Kaplan?
let's do the introduction first,
Oh.
okay? So everyone knows who we are.
All righty.
I'm Michael Cohen. I'm a fellow at the Century Foundation, columnist at The Guardian, and writer of all types of articles about various subjects of interest.
And I'm Thanasi Kambanis, also a fellow at the Century Foundation. I'm a columnist at the Boston Globe, and I had the pleasure of covering the war in Iraq for 3 years as a
Yes.
correspondent for the Boston Globe from 2003 to 2006, hence my personal interest in the story we're talking about today.
Sure.
So you read Fred Kaplan's book,
I did.
The Insurgents,
I did.
about
I read
counter.
it most of it last night, actually, to be honest. And it's an interesting read. It's very what I found interesting about it was that he very much focused on the personalities, which I guess is sort of that's kind of the thing in publishing now, I suppose. It's very much character driven and personality driven. But and we'll talk about this a little bit. I think he kind of buried the lead a little bit on counterinsurgency.
Well, so he's trying to tell the story of the idea of counterinsurgency, but also sort of through a biography of the much maligned David Petraeus, right? So he's showing
Right.
this,
Well, malign depends who you ask, I suppose.
right? The hero, the loathed hero of Washington, D.C. and the Pentagon. So the main argument he makes in this book, right, is that counterinsurgency really was the equivalent of a sort of intellectual revolution in military circles, and he tries to trace the history of this idea way back to the 50s and 60s, to Algeria, Vietnam, and then through sort of the way it percolated through the ranks of the military and then exploded, pardon the metaphor, out into the world of policymaking when the Iraq War began to go adrift a few years after the invasion. And the hero of his story is, I guess he has two heroes. He has Petraeus as a hero, and this idea of coin as a sort of new way of understanding war, as a hero there.
Right, and I think there were two issues that I had with the approach that he took. One is he focused on personality. So John Nagle, who is sort of seen as kind of the main coin kind of advocates, one of the main coinistas, is gets a sort of large biographical sketch of his development, and that was interesting. I mean, I feel like the story's been told a lot, but it was interesting nonetheless. But I think for me, what I would have liked more of was to understand why Nagle's theory about counterinsurgency was generally wrong. The thing about that I found less interesting about Nagle was how he developed his views, but the fact that a lot of his views, particularly his talk about his focus on Malaya and the counterinsurgencies of Malaya and Vietnam, have been contradicted by a great many historians. And I think, as we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq, haven't quite worked out the way that he had sort of speculated at the time.
Right, and so
Yeah.
you bring up something that really that sort of speaks to one of the big, the reasons why this is interesting, but also the big problem with any honest conversation about counterinsurgency,
Yes.
which is it's an idea that was born in failed wars half a century ago, the French scorched earth campaign in Algeria, the early and late failures in Vietnam, the British imperial experiment in Malaya, and so on, and then later Iraq and Afghanistan. So this whole idea is one that's been sort of forged in failures, and yet gets trotted out to sort of give us a blueprint for how to occupy and nation build in countries where arguably we have no business sending our military in the first place.
Right, and I think one of the problems with the counterinsurgency theory in general that was been pushed over the last couple of years is that it operates under this sort of argument that this is a sort of more humane style of war, that it represents a different type of conflict, and in a way it gets the history of counterinsurgency wrong, in the sense that what allowed counterinsurgency operations to succeed in places like Malaya and Algeria and Kenya. and elsewhere was and succeeded, by the way, a relative term. But what allowed them to succeed was not that they sort of captured the hearts and minds of the population, not that they got the population on their side, rather that they brutalized the population. Rather, they forcibly separated the population from the insurgents and did so in a way that we could never do today in a place like Iraq.
Yeah, and I guess when people in Washington talk about counterinsurgency, they often use that phrase, hearts and minds.
Right.
And in fact, that's not even what counterinsurgency purports to be, right? The in its honest form, what counterinsurgency claims is that you're trying to get the foreign population over to your side so that population is not your enemy. Your enemy is the insurgent, and the population
right.
can sometimes be a target, sometimes something you protect, but essentially they're the prize rather than a body count of the enemy. And, you know, taken to its logical implication, counterinsurgency is in no way a recipe for being kind to people, right? I mean, you know, the Malaya example was where they forcibly moved entire populations to take them away
yes.
from their villages and put them in camps for years until they could defeat the guerrillas that had been operating amongst them. And that's, you know, that's a successful counterinsurgency. And like you say, that's something that only a few foolish people in the 21st century tried to apply in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right, and I think this is a really important point, and I think it can't be expressed enough. You know, the key to success in counterinsurgency is coercion, and even by the way, that doesn't even guarantee success. But it's coercion of the population. It's coercion by often violent means, by as you mentioned, Malaya forced resettlement. In Algeria, it meant, you know, extreme violence perpetrated and torture perpetrated by the French colonial regime. Same situation, some extent in Kenya. Even what allowed some of the success in Vietnam was, you know, the Phoenix Program, the assassination of Viet Cong officers and insurgents. So what's sort of missing from the coin debate is the role of coercion. And in a sense, you know, it's interesting if you look at, though, Iraq and why Iraq turned around, it had a lot more to do with coercion, a lot more to do with violence than it did with, you know, the U.S. military being a learning organization that figured out how to wage counterinsurgency effectively. And when I say the coercion, it came, you know, both from the U.S. in the form of a ramped-up military operations that coincided with the surge, but even much more importantly, it had to do with the what happened on the ground vis-a-vis the Iraqis. And I'm speaking, of course, of the ethnic cleansing and enclaving of Baghdad, the decision by in Anbar by Sunnis to turn against AQI. You know, what allowed the surge to succeed and what, you know, it was really a lot of violence and a lot of forced separation of insurgents,
and
also the fact that the Shiites basically won. So that was sort of what, you know, they had kind of been somewhat successful.
And I want to break this down. And before we get into our mostly agreement and probably some disagreement about what actually happened in the surge, I just want to make one distinction about counterinsurgency, which I don't think Fred Kaplan makes too much in his book, but which to me is really important to understanding what's happened in America's sort of long war on terror. And that's that we approach these wars in a quite like a rigid doctrinaire fashion. I'm not talking about the march to war from the White House. I'm talking about the way the wars themselves are executed from the Pentagon on down. Rigid, sort of moribund, not clear thinking, not smart strategy and tactics. And then on the ground, there was a large number of officers, mostly junior officers, who were autonomous, creative, imaginative, and used common sense and sort of their just sort of practical know-how to try and take these sort of disastrous missions with which they'd been saddled and figure out a way to sort of muddle through and go forward. And these are laudable people, you know, in the way they try to do their job out there. The discussion about these wars and the discussion about Corrin often conflates that sort of small current of common sense and autonomy with the idea of coin. And in fact, those aren't the same things, right? There was sort
They're
of
not.
Countless officers out there who said, as by the way, a great quote in the book, General George Casey says to someone after he gets put in charge of Iraq, he turns to someone and says, "George Bush has handed me a pile of shit." And that's his assessment of the True. Iraq War in 2005. And yeah, and so the common sense strain are the people who say, okay, I've been handed a pile of crap here, but what can I do to make it, you know, to screw it up the least amount possible? And that is not actually the same thing as counterinsurgency doctrine. That's pragmatism, common sense, and
to your point here, I mean, this is actually one of my frustrations a little bit with the book, that the book is all about, you know, how these insurgents inside the U.S. Army were able to push this, you know, alternative strategy for dealing with the war in Iraq. It's all about how they wanted to sort of correct the sort of hidebound army doctrine approach. And it kind of it gives the idea, as a lot of the coin folks do, that this, you know, that coin fights and these kinds of changes happen because of leadership shifts, right? So what happened in Malaya was that you went from, you know, Briggs to Templar. And in Vietnam, it was from Westmoreland to Abrams. So it's the shift in commander is crucial. The problem a little bit with that argument, and this is something that I wish Kaplan had kind of engaged a little bit more, is that the most important thing that happened in Iraq in 2006 that allowed for the violence in Iraq to begin to dissipate somewhat was what Seth MacFarlane was doing in Anbar province, which is basically working with the local Sunni groups there to marginalize and to frankly destroy AQI, Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Right, and here I think we're probably going to be in agreement with each other and in disagreement with the Washington commentariat in general, which is, you know, when we talk about what actually happened in the surge and what role Petraeus played. And I'll start by saying, I think the whole vocabulary of the surge is false, because, you know, the surge suggests that we sent a lot more troops and it changed the course of everything
right.
in Iraq.
Right.
And in fact, Iraq was changing in no small part because of things we were doing, often though for the worse. And then it was changing a lot because of things that were happening on the ground in the civil war that was going on
right.
between Shia militias and the government, Shia militias and Sunni militias against the Americans, and Sunni militias against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And all those things took on developments of their own that we got to capitalize on during what we called the surge, and then take credit for. And in terms of personality-driven heroic narratives, it's, you know, Petraeus gets top marks for being either shameless enough or bold enough or both to take credit for all manner of historical events that he had no influence over.
Right, and just to get back to the MacFarlane point, I mean, what's sort of fascinating about that example was that MacFarlane basically says he didn't know about Nagel and Petraeus, what they were doing with coin. He wasn't, I mean, he had read some, you know, Galula and some coin books, and he had some sense of what to do, but he was sort of acting somewhat ad hoc. He wasn't taking guidance from Petraeus or anybody else in Washington who was pushing this. He was responding to what was happening on the ground. And this is a point that, you know, that John Gentile makes all the time. And by the way, it's sort of bizarre that Kaplan doesn't even mention Gentile in the entire book. I found that very strange because, I mean, Gentile has been one of the most persistent critics of counterinsurgency in the U.S. military, certainly. So,
and he gave a very scathing review to this book as well.
Yeah, I haven't read the review yet. I don't want to read it before him, but I'm sure he's not a big fan of it. But the thing is that what it points out is that this idea that Petraeus kind of came in 07 and made all these changes, I mean, it doesn't totally square with what happened in Anbar, and doesn't really square with what you just pointed out, with all the things that were happening on the ground. You know, one thing that it's sort of frustrating a little bit is that there is this sense in the book that there was all this sort of U.S. agency was responsible for what happened. But there's not a very compelling case made for how this kind of approach of outreach to the population actually really made a difference. I mean, what Kaplan says, and this is actually the most fascinating part of the book, is like page 268 and 269 are my favorite pages of the book. Because basically, after this whole thing about how, you know, this coin doctrine and how it progressed from, you know, even in the mid-90s to, like, even going even before that to the early 90s, how it progressed to the point when Trace took over. He talks about the surge and how Silicon Valley went down and how there was, you know, more stability. And then he basically says, but it really wasn't to do with coin. It really had to do with, you know, all of the ethnic cleansing that happened in 2005, 2006. And had to do with the fact that that the Sunnis turned on AQI. I mean, in a way, he's basically after this whole argument about the effect that coin had, he kind of says, "But don't read too much into it." Well, you know, that's a problem, and it suggests in a way, to me at least, that the narrative that he's putting out there and the narrative that Coinistas are putting out there is very flawed. And I think this is what your point is as well. There's a lot more nuance to what happened in Iraq than just Petraeus came in, started doing coin, and then we had success.
Well, and I want to talk a little bit about what Petraeus actually did, because this is sure. a story that doesn't get told enough, and it doesn't get told in this book either. When Petraeus went to Mosul, that was his success in sort of pacifying this huge Sunni city that was later a hotbed of the resistance was sort of talked about even at the time in reverential tones as like, yeah. Oh, this is one part of Iraq that's being handled well.
Right.
Well, what the guy did there, and for good and for ill, what he did there was he didn't use overwhelming force against civilians. He was careful not to, you know, kill a lot of random people while patrolling the city. He brought in smart aides that he knew from other positions in the military, other posts that he'd held in the military and from West Point, and he bought a lot of people off. And,
right.
and this now this is a sound conflict management. I'm not criticizing that particular tactic. He paid off people usually in the form of hiring them to be in the police, even though they were known militants. And they returned the favor by not attacking Americans concertedly until he left.
Right.
And his successor stopped paying them. And so that in my book, that's a small success and a big failure, because if you essentially give the insurgency time to rest and gather strength and then and come up with some sort of very jerry-rigged short-term measure that falls apart and blows up in the face of the unit that replaces you. Sure, the successor unit is somewhat at fault, but that's not a good approach, right? That's not a problem solved.
It's not a sustainable deferred, which is what we saw in Mosul, and we saw that repeatedly. That things that were doing on a small scale in order to get the population on their side was not sustainable. And by the way, this is exactly the problem we've had in Afghanistan. And I think that speaks to a really big hole in this whole coin theory argument.
Well, right, and yes, absolutely, and the sort of the part of it that might be laudable again is the part where you're supporting improvisation, you're supporting creative problem solving. But you know, when we look at Petraeus and a lot of the Coindonistas, what we see is that they're trying at all times to sort of please people and do what works, but often their priority problem is pleasing their bosses in Washington and not let's say managing the war properly.
Right.
So the next position Petraeus takes in Iraq after Mosul is he takes charge of the training mission,
right,
where he turns out he presides over the new army and police training that turns out literally hundreds of thousands of armed Iraqis in a one-year span who, by all accounts, including the U.S. government's later audits, were not trained
right.
at all. But he happily trains these guys for a few weeks, gives them weapons,
yeah.
and then publishes reports saying, yep, another 30,000
right.
this month, another 60,000
right.
this month. We're standing up Iraqi so we can stand down. And that was a huge load of BS. And it was a dangerous load of BS because it was the fallow period that actually led to the horrifying bloodletting, ethnic cleansing, and death squads of 2006.
That's right. And let me say one other thing, too. You know, when Petraeus took over in 2007, right, when the surge began, I mean, two of the defining features of the surge, let me say that one of the defining features was significantly increased violence. I mean, airstrikes went up about four deaths from airstrikes went about fourfold. We were putting many more Iraqis in detention than we were previously. There was some elements of this sort of FM324, counterinsurgency approach, but really we just were using a lot of violence in order to suppress the insurgency, and we were supporting groups that were also using violence to express insurgency. We also got lucky. We had a ceasefire with the Mahdi army. Now, of course, they were able to go after the Mahdi army, which is what led to that ceasefire. And there's a strong connection here between the increase in, decrease in violence and the increase in American military violence. And I'm not criticizing that. I mean, that's actually how you theoretically would win wars, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with adopting that strategy. But then don't spin it as if somehow you're doing something revolutionary or something that's really advanced. I mean, in a sense, you're taking advantage of the battlefield as it stands in order to further your games. And I think Petraeus deserves enormous credit for that. I mean, I think that he does, and a lot of the commanders like McMaster and McFarland, others on the ground, they deserve a lot of credit. But let's be clear about what they did and what they did not do.
And it's because the level of thinking was so crappy that these kinds of insights seem so brilliant.
Right,
so
right.
The fact that there are people who would say, civilian casualties don't make any difference. You can, bomb a wedding party by accident and it doesn't matter. That's a specious and stupid claim. And it takes, the genius of one of these, coin commanders to say, oh, hey, wait a second. We make enemies for ourselves when we kill innocent people. So we should actually, even when using maximal force, we should still be careful not to target innocent people.
Right.
Is that coin? No, that's not coin. That's common sense. Now, it's rare, at least at times in the first, 5 or 6 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, that kind of thinking was rare, and I think it's getting rare again, and that's a sad testament to our muddled thinking, but that's not an argument for coin or any other particular dogma or doctrine.
Right.
That's simply, I believe you can actually make things worse for yourself by turning people against you by the way you wage war and occupy, and I would hope most people would see that way no matter what.
Right, but I think that the larger lesson that you might take away from this is that occupying countries are bad. Now, you can argue that in Iraq, the U.S. military was in a difficult situation. They had been sent on a mission a poorly conceived mission by the Bush administration, and they had to sort of make, the best of a bad situation. The problem was that these guys then sort of thought they figured out, they figured out this new American way of war and tried to import it to Afghanistan. And that's where they didn't really get into trouble. I just say one other thing. I think one of the problems we have here a little bit with this sort of coin discussion is that I made this point before and it sort of drives me a little bit crazy, but for these coin guys, coin is whatever they define it is at that moment. It's like if they're using lots of violence to kill insurgents, that's coin. If they're paying off insurgents, that's coin. If they're walking on a patrol and they're building sewer systems, that's coin. I mean, whatever basically works is coin. I think it's a very self-interest argument. And I have to say, I haven't read a biography of Petraeus, but one of the takeaways from the book that was, I don't know if this was intended by Kaplan or just sort of unintentional, is that Petraeus comes across a little creepily. There's something about his nature that suggests that, he's really insecure and he needs to sort of to be kind of the big man on campus and needs to be have this new doctrine that he put out there that he's responsible for and that he deserves credit for. There's something about his personality that I found a little bit uncomfortable.
He's pushed this idea. Petraeus himself has successfully sold the idea that the reason why he isn't popular among his peers is because he's so smart. That's actually when you think about it, that's a brilliant self.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Now, the real reason why he's unpopular with at least some of his colleagues, and I know this because I've interviewed them, is because they think he's a self-serving opportunist who doesn't really care what the results are as long as his bosses are happy and are willing to promote him. And that's their, that's what they see when they look at Mosul, when they look at the command of his command of the training command, and they say, look, this guy doesn't actually give a crap how it turns out. He just cares that he's pleasing his boss at the moment. And think about that. In 2004, Petraeus, while training these shoddy, Potemkin soldiers, wrote an op-ed in the Post about how great the war was going at a very helpful time for Bush's reelection campaign. And shortly thereafter, he got another promotion.
Right.
Now, is that a coincidence? I don't think so. I think that's smart career management. That's not truth-telling. And we do see this thing. I mean, I've been on this crusade for a long time about the representing the reality based community in these conversations about Iraq and the war on terror, of course the Coindonistas would claim like yes they're part of the reality based community that sees things as they are, but I would say actually they have continued that sort of steeped in BS, willing to misrepresent real-time history in order to win their bureaucratic debate at the time.
Right.
And that's the thing with the surge, right? So what happens in the surge, just to put a fine point on it, is that by coincidence, the Sunnis turn against al-Qaeda. At the same time, the most powerful Shia militia in Iraq declares a unilateral ceasefire, right, because its own leader is concerned about rogue units, and he decides that he'll order his loyalists to stand down, knowing that the ones who don't stand down, he's happy to have them killed by the Americans because they're not obeying his orders in the first place.
Right.
That's when we come in with our extra troops. So of course, if we tell the truth about that, and if we tell the truth about the fact that we came in after most of Iraq was ethnically cleansed and all the mixed neighborhoods had turned into homogenous enclaves, well, of course, it's a hell of a lot easier to stabilize that situation because it's a war that's already coming to a close of its own right. It's a civil war that one side has already essentially won. And then we come in and clean up, and sure, that's not a easy job, but it's also not the sort of game changer that it's made out to be by Petraeus and Nagel and in some ways by Kaplan's story here.
Right. I mean, I think that's the sort of bottom line here, is that they grabbed on to a narrative that allowed them to kind of push this argument they had rediscovered war, and of course all credit then goes to David Petraeus, and that's part of the issue. But I will say also one thing too, and again, this was something I noticed reading Kaplan's book, that all the discussions that went on inside the military, and you're talking about the conferences that were held at Leavenworth and other sort of informal discussions that went on by these sort of insurgents trying to push this new kind of theory of war fighting. You know who never seems to be involved in these conversations? Anyone who's A, Iraqi, and B, knows anything about the Middle East. I mean, that was what I found like the most fascinating thing about it. It was that, and I could have knew this, but I sort of need to be reminded of it. They appear to take no effort to actually speak with Iraqis, to understand the region. Instead, you have people like Ralph Peters going out and saying, it's all about religion with these people. I mean, which is, a very simplistic way of looking at the situation. But and even like people like Bing West who are challenging this and who made good challenges to the arguments that these guys were making, but no one, basically was it appeared inside these discussions that went on, were sort of presenting it from the Iraqi perspective, which seems rather important.
These guys are experts in war.
It was really troubling I knew this, but to read it again was very troubling, about the extent to which the human rights community kind of gave a stamp of approval to this this effort, this coin effort, and in particular, they mentioned Sarah Sewell at Kennedy School, who co-sponsored some of these conferences looking at counterinsurgency. There was just a little lack of questioning. A lot of people who had, for political reasons, wanted to go along with this, but there was again very very little involved with people who understood the region, and very little as far as just like real social scientists, real anthropologists who could have actually provided better insight. I mean, this was kind of a lot of the stuff here was, I think, intellectually kind of claptrap. And you sort of see that when you read FM 324 and you see what happened on the ground.
Well, and so the bottom line here is that the folks who are, the folks in the military, fortunately, unfortunately, their job is to do whatever mission they were handed.
Right.
And they are not, by statute, they're not allowed to say, this mission is either impossible or completely stupid or horrible for the American national interest and we shouldn't do it. Once we've invaded Iraq and we're occupying it, or once we've invaded Afghanistan and we're occupying it, the Marines and infantry men and so on who are over there running the war, not only do they sort of have to just figure out how to do the mission they've been served up, but they have a built-in incentive not only to try and make it work, but to try and make it work in a way that it maintains their troop levels and
right,
their budget flows, unfortunately for the Pentagon and the military, these long wars have been, you know, no matter what people say in there, who pretend to complain about how it's only been, you know, grinding op tempo and all this, they've been great for the Pentagon and the military.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge buildup. It's really raised their political clout and their profile in the American culture, and it's been a huge boost. And I don't say this lightly. I mean, for the men and women who are, you know, getting killed and risking their lives, is a, you know, it's not at all a glib thing they take lightly. But for the Pentagon chiefs and the people who are the architects of these doctrines and these wars, it's been a huge boon. And we saw this in the pivot to Afghanistan. They're sort of happy to shift as long as there's going to be another big one, another big war, and hopefully, you know, from their perspective, an open-ended occupation and counterinsurgency, which is, you know, much more useful for arguing for big budgets than a finite small war like, say, the Panama intervention.
Well, can I just say one thing that's sort of interesting in the book is that Casey, you know, who was the commander there prior to Petraeus, you know, comes across rather poorly in the book. He's presented as the guy who, like, didn't want to support counterinsurgency, you know, was resistant to getting the U.S. more involved, he was opposed to the surge. And in a weird way, you know, and I think there's some real flaws with Casey, there's actually something to his arguments that are heroic is not a good word, obviously, but he was right. I mean, his argument was that, you know, we can't solve this war. The Iraqis have to solve this war. And in fact, the more that we involve ourselves in it, the harder it is to educate ourselves, and the harder it is for us to solve it. And in a sense, he was kind of the guy in the military who rejected the kind of the knee-jerk can-doism of the American military, which we can solve every problem. And he was saying, we need to actually diminish our presence. Now, I could argue that was wrong.
Hold on. I think of Casey as sort of the ultimate symbol of the crusty old dinosaur thinking in the U.S. military. And I actually spent the day of the Samarra Shrine bombing in February 2006 with General Casey, flying to different bases in and around Baghdad as the country was literally getting engulfed in flames.
Right.
So that, you know, that day the Samarra Shrine gets blown up, a holy Shia shrine. That's the day that the ethnic civil war really kicked off in full gear. And this guy, Casey, doesn't change his schedule for the day. Instead of canceling these routine briefings he had with his colonels around the city, and going to meet with his, you know, sort of top war commanders and with the Iraqi government to figure out how the hell to staunch this complete and utter collapse,
right,
he goes literally for 8 hours straight, to these bases, in which he tells people that the only priority they should have is to turn over their areas of operation to Iraqi troops as soon as possible.
Right.
And this dynamic was terrifying, because these colonels were saying, or lieutenant colonels were saying, you know, sir, they're not ready. You know, we're getting attacked and blown up and killed, and so are the people in this neighborhood every day. If we turn it over to this Iraqi company here, it's more people are going to die. We won't die. And what he was essentially saying was, hey, not our problem. You know, stand
right.
them up so we can stand down.
And let me say this. I mean, I don't want to get the impression of defending Casey in this one, because I'm not.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Because his problem was that he showed the lack of flexibility that, you know, I think in fairness, this is the case that the coin folks were making, was so damaging to the military in Iraq. But, you know, what I would say is that his notion that, you know, ultimately there was only so much the U.S. could do to solve this problem, and that we should be sort of, you know, cognizant of limitations of what American military can do, was correct. It may have been the wrong sort of approach in 2005, 2006 after the Samarra Mosque explosion. But, you know, he had a point. And in a way, you know, what's interesting I find is that you can sort of portray Casey as sort of crusty, old school, and not inflexible to change. And that's true. And the counterinsurgents were – the insurgents inside the military and Petraeus and Nagel and so forth were intended to sort of fix that and make the U.S. military more flexible. But the problem, if you look at it, is they actually did the opposite. They made the military more inflexible. And what I mean by that is that after the supposed success of the surge in 2007, 2008, they came away from that saying, we figured out how to fight counterinsurgency and we can take this lesson to Afghanistan. You know, even though it's a completely different country, totally different, you know, conflict, we can impart the lesson that we've learned here. This is exactly what they were complaining about by old school, guys who were trained about, you know, invading and fighting wars in the Fold the Gap.
So they take the wrong lesson from Iraq in the first place, right? They say, ha, we turned it around in Iraq because we brought more troops and we adopted Field Manual 324.
FM 324, yes, exactly.
And the new gospel of counterinsurgency. So I think we both agree that's not actually true. That's not what happened. But they told this story. They told it to Washington. They told it to themselves. And then instead of acknowledging that a lot of the stability that came to Iraq was a lucky accident, they said, holy crap, America found the recipe. We got the snake oil. And then they took it to Afghanistan.
Right.
So let's talk about Afghanistan.
I mean, I think, look, Afghanistan is where you see the ultimate failure of counterinsurgency. Let me rephrase that. You see the ultimate failure of what Petraeus was trying to accomplish, and Nagel as well, and in fact this entire sort of movement inside the army. They became what they had rebelled against, and when you look at what happened in Afghanistan, was they tried to impart these lessons. I mean, I remember seeing Petraeus in April of 2009 at the CNS conference, explaining to me with this, to me and lots of other people. In this PowerPoint presentation, how they had been successful in Iraq, and how they're going to be that was going to be transmitted to Afghanistan, and of course, it didn't work out anywhere close to that way. In fact, we can look at it now and we can say that the COIN mission in Afghanistan failed, and it failed miserably for reasons, by the way, that should have been obvious at the time. Obvious if you looked at Afghanistan from rather than a tactical standpoint that the military does, but from a strategic standpoint. You know, we have the safe haven in Pakistan. You have an undependable government in Kabul. You have an 18-month time frame imposed by the president, but in general, you have political constraints that will prevent you from doing a full-scale counterinsurgency. All of these elements prevent success and should have been, by the way, warning signs that this isn't going to work. Some of us made those comments, these should have been warning signs, and were ignored. But the reality is that they tried to take these lessons and bring them to Afghanistan in a way that I think it not only hurt the military, hurt COIN doctrine, but it really hurt Afghanistan and it hurt U.S. interests there. We're going to leave Afghanistan in a much worse place than we found it because we've squandered, in my view, 18 months on this ridiculous COIN mission that hasn't been successful at all. And more than 18 months, in 3 years, we wasted on this COIN mission that has not succeeded and has left Afghanistan in a much worse place than it was before.
Right. And the problem in Afghanistan isn't COIN per se, but is that we have an untenable occupation, right? I mean, we went in there in 2001, ostensibly to get Al-Qaeda. We did about as much of that as we were willing to do, maybe right, within the first 6 months. And then everything we've done literally since then has been based on two things that never happened. One is we were going to set up a stable Afghan government. Forget about a friendly or liberal or anything. Just a stable one. We can't do that. And the other was later to rout the Taliban. No more Taliban. Well, guess what? The Taliban's as strong as it's been at any point since the summer of 2001. So on the two things we're supposedly accomplishing there, we completely failed. And I would argue, with COIN, without COIN, with twice as many troops, with half as many troops, the fear would be the same because that's actually an impossible mission.
Right.
We can't occupy that country. I mean, it's hard to occupy any country. And, this isn't post-war defeated Japan or Germany. This is, this is a country that's got the one thing it's really a world leader in is in repelling foreign invaders and occupiers, and it's got a near perfect record for centuries on this.
But can I just say also, excuse me, it also speaks a little bit.
Bless you.
Thank you very much. I'm just fighting a bit of a cold here. It also speaks to the intellectual sloppiness of the COIN folks, and what I mean by that is that so in April of April and May of 2009. McKiernan gets replaced as a commander in Afghanistan. He's a four-star, first four-star let go since I think MacArthur. McChrystal
big
comes
deal,
on.
Big deal, right? That they fired him.
They fired him.
It's a huge,
they fired
huge
him.
Thing.
McChrystal comes on, and we're told he gets COIN. Okay, he understands it. He puts out this review, assisted by useful think tankers, basically arguing that the only strategy that will work is population-centric counterinsurgency. No other approach will work in Afghanistan except population-centric counterinsurgency, which is basically FM 324. He goes in there, and he begins to actually do counterinsurgency as the book describes it, right? Not as actually Petraeus did it in Iraq, but as the book describes it. So that means, you know, restrictive rules of engagement in fighting
It means risking more American deaths in order to minimize Afghan civilians.
Right. It means going out of your way to minimize civilian casualties. Of course, missing the point that once you send 30,000 more Americans into southern Afghanistan, by its very nature, you are going to kill more Afghan civilians. Okay? If your goal is to kill fewer Afghan civilians, don't put American troops there to fight the Taliban and have civilians stuck in the middle of that, which is basically what's happened. Okay? So that's COIN, right? So that's McChrystal doing COIN in Afghanistan, right? Restrictive rules of engagement, you know, fewer airstrikes and approach to sort of, you know, they want to outshore, that was the comment, outshore the Taliban, and they want to bring government in a box. That was, I mean, amazing expression, to Helmand. We're going to invade Helmand, we're going to send troops to Helmand, we're going to bring government in a box, we're going to convince the Afghans to come to the government side. Okay. So what happens? And McChrystal gets fired because he says something stupid to Rolling Stone, and Petraeus takes over. And what does Petraeus do? Well, guess what?
He throws COIN out the window.
Throws this like populist-centric social science BS out the window, and starts increasing airstrikes. He starts, you know, more detentions. He starts, you know, the rules of engagement shift. I mean, it's like, you know, again, it's what COIN's whatever they want it to be at that exact moment. So, you know, all of a sudden that now we're doing what Petraeus did in Iraq, which is we're trying to kill as many Taliban as possible. And we did, by the way, very successfully. Killed a lot of Taliban. So definitely killed their momentum.
And I think this is one of the strongest parts of Kaplan's book. When he gets to Afghanistan and Petraeus' role in as he portrays it, trying to, you know, trick the president or box in the White House into having this COIN surge after Obama takes office, Kaplan's reporting here is really damning, because what he shows is that Petraeus and the rest of the Pentagon really, first of all, they didn't think it would work, but they didn't care. They just wanted to extend the war there for their own bureaucratic reasons of growing the army. They not only didn't think it would work, but they just didn't think the president would have the political cojones after, you know, so they said, okay, give us a year and a half, we'll turn it around. And they actually thought when a year and a half had gone by and nothing had changed, they would just get another year and a half or two or ten. And they were shocked. They were totally shocked that Obama said, well, you know, this is what you asked for. I gave it to you and it didn't work. And now we are drawing down. We're going to withdraw because there's no way to win this. And the tragedy here on all fronts is that neither Obama nor the Pentagon had either the honesty or the political spine to just say in 2009, you know, several hundred or a thousand deaths ago, hey, we're not going to accomplish what we want there. We've done as much as we can. Let's just get out now, because this is just basically extra deaths on both sides so that there could be a more politically expedient way for us to get out. And I find that actually horrifying.
I find it horrifying, too. And I will say this. I mean, I wrote about this at the time, and it's a big, you know, it's a real sort of issue, frustration for me. You know, the military went from being advisors to advocates, right? They went and they launched a public relations campaign to box the president in, to force him to send more troops to Afghanistan. After, you know, he'd already sent 17,000 in February. They had a review in March of 2009, which basically said no more troops. Then McChrystal comes on and basically, you know, him and Petraeus and all the COINistas out there basically, you know, put a lot of public pressure on Obama. Mike Mullen was certainly one of the main protagonists in this effort, and Gates and Hillary went along with it to box the president in Afghanistan and to force him to send more troops, which he did. Now, that's not a defense of Obama. I mean, he shouldn't have done it, and he should have been strong enough to say no to them, but he wasn't. But, you know, to my mind, and I've said this before, I think it created one of the more troubling civ-mil crisis in this country in the last, you know, 20, 30 years, if not longer. And there's something I'll just mention really quickly. There's something in Rajiv's book, Rajiv Chandra Sakharan, if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, his book on Afghanistan. He raises this point that, you know, Obama in the fall of 2009 says to Petraeus, you know, and to the generals, here's what I want you to do. You know, I don't want you to go into places that you can't turn over to the Afghan army in 18 months. Or, you know, I don't want you to take on more territory you can't hold. And Rajiv has this quote from one of Petraeus' advisors saying, yeah, we basically ignored that. And they did. They went into Helmand, you know, and they with no hope turning over to the Afghans in 18 months.
Yeah, it's a remarkably disingenuous story. Petraeus' trajectory in Afghanistan, and you know, the thing about COIN and the thing about these its advocates is they've tried to set up a reality in which they can always argue they were right, and that the failure was that we didn't do enough COIN or that we didn't send enough troops.
That's always the argument.
And it reminds me, I mean, I was at a July 4th party in the U.S. Embassy in 2004. In Baghdad, at the time Iraq was a disaster, and there was a whole bunch of professional Americans who were going, on TV every day talking about what a success it was. And a very senior State Department official, actually, who I hitherto thought was a reasonable guy, turns to me at this party and says, you know, we were winning Vietnam when they finally pulled the plug on it. You know, we'd finally gotten it right, and that's when they gave up. And if we had just stayed the course for a few more years, we would have won. Now I happen to think that's cockamamie.
It is cockamamie.
But that is the kind of thinking. That's, you know, I mean, I won't say this guy was a COIN guy, but that's almost magical COIN thinking, you know. And that's the same thing we're going to hear 2 years from now, 5 years from now, when Petraeus is retired at some think tank. He's going to be talking about, if only we had stayed the course in Afghanistan 2 or 3 more years and 100,000 more troops, we would have won. And, you know, Afghanistan would have somehow, you know, turned into, Switzerland or Liechtenstein. And I think that's dangerous, anti-reality crap. And that's the, you know, when we pull back here, and I think, you know, at the end of this conversation is, what do we take from the long war on terror and COIN? And I think the first thing we take is that, hey, abstract ideas should have almost no place in the debate about should we invade a country, should we go to war, and should we occupy a foreign country.
Yeah, and I agree with all of what you just said, and I just make one point about the Vietnam analogy is sort of fascinating, because this is kind of Noggle's argument, makes his argument too, that had we done COIN earlier in Vietnam, we would have been more successful. And of course, you know, my response to this, and again, John Gentile's written a lot about this, and he's the guy, the go-to guy in this issue, you know, the reason we lost in Vietnam is because we had a bad strategy. And we didn't have the political will to win the war. And that's ultimately why we lost. And we never should have gotten involved in the first place. The reason why Iraq was a disaster is very similar, actually, because we should never have gotten involved in the first place, and we had a crappy strategy. Even if Iraq turns out to be somewhat of a stable democracy, it doesn't mean that the war wasn't a disaster for U.S. interests. And, of course, the same thing with Afghanistan. And this is the problem when you let military folks basically dictate strategy. You know, I mean, I have to say, one of the things about the book that I find, and this is, again, I don't know if Kaplan intended this, but it certainly comes across, that these guys have just absolute tunnel vision. They see everything through the prism of tactics, of what the military can accomplish, and they seem to just ignore the larger strategic implications of the strategies they're pushing. People like McChrystal and Petraeus talking about, you know, counterinsurgency, talking about, in Afghanistan, it's sort of almost ignorant of the political restraints on such a policy for the president. I mean, I know their job isn't to do politics, but they have to certainly be cognizant of those political constraints, and they're not.
And I guess what makes me sad and wistful as we sort of trash COIN and its advocates is that, you know, on the ground in these countries and sort of at the lower levels of the U.S. military, the rise of the COIN dogma and BS was accompanied by something that was actually really great, which was the rise of young, critical thinking, creative officers who were not enthralled to their careers, but were actually trying to solve problems in inventive ways, who questioned authority, who were willing to actually criticize the mission internally. And that was great. It was really refreshing to see, you know, in particular in Iraq, to see these officers who were saying, hey, you know what, I'm in the military because I care about my country and I'm smart and I want to think for myself. I'm not in it in order to try and make brigadier general and throw my integrity by the wayside.
Right.
That was great. And unfortunately, it seems like the COIN fad is coming to its close, and it's already sort of getting gradually discarded by the military establishment. And I'm afraid that with that, goes the sort of short-lived and quite desirable, actually, current of critical thinking and imagination in the ranks of the U.S. military.
Yeah, there's something to that. I mean, but you know, look, here's what sort of what's fascinating. I mean, I'm willing to let that go if it puts aside these ridiculous coin ideas. And the thing that I find,
you'll take a brittle army if it's not an interventionist army. In other words,
I'm sorry.
You'll take a brittle military as long as it's not.
Well, it's not a brittle military. It's just, and the thing is, you're right about the critical thinking, but I kind of have. I kind of disagree a little bit. Actually, I don't think you're right. I mean, what ended up happening was that you had people in the military who basically fell into line with this new coin doctrine. That this became the new sort of a company line, and everyone fell in place to promulgate it. And I saw that.
Right, when everybody thinks outside the box in the same way.
It's not thinking really, outside the box. It's thinking outside the old box, but thinking inside of a new box, which is what happened. You know, and to me, that I don't see that as a huge, you know, step forward. And look, here's what I find fascinating. When I started writing about counterinsurgency, I didn't know a lot about it, and I was writing about it three and a half years ago in the context of Afghanistan. And I mean, you could at that time. This was all people wanted to talk about was coin. Everyone had theories on coin. They were like, you know, coin, you know, superstars, and there were all these coin conferences. And boy, you don't hear about coin at all anymore. I mean, you just don't hear about it. It is no longer the sexy, faddish theory that it was 4 years ago. And the people who were pushing it, and they know who they are, have sort of moved on to other topics that are, you know.
At the end of the day, the joke is that, you know, coin actually is what it is. Coin is one of many important military doctrines out there, including, you know, the doctrine that governs how to use artillery when, you know, when trying to take over, you know, an enemy position. And no one would say, you know, when we wrote the new artillery field manual, let's say, no one said, hey, this is a new way of war. They said, hey, you know, we're just adapting to the times and updating how we fire big guns. And that's all coin is, and that's all it should be.
I think it's a little more than that. I mean, I think it's a whole theory that, you know, the future is going to be these uncomfortable wars. This is sort of Petraeus' argument.
No, that's what these guys made it out to be. But in fact, what it is coin is the guide for what you do if you end up committing to a counterinsurgency. So, you know, so the judgment has to be made. Are we in a counterinsurgency and should we pursue it? And that's one of many different kinds of conflict that we could end up involved in. And then if and when we do, that's when we pull out this set of tactics and say, okay, we find ourselves occupying a hostile urban area and it's important enough to us to stay there that we want to pacify it. What should we do? Well, in that case, of course, we do want to do coin, right? We don't want to do...
Right, but keep in mind, Thanasi, but this was also something else that went on here too, which is that the argument became that this is the future. Right, these kind of failed states, these kinds of nation-building efforts, this is the future of war. Right, you know what we're going to do it all over the world. And in fact, you know what Obama did. I mean, I criticize him, and he deserves criticism. It's the worst decision he made as president was to escalate in 2009. But I give him a lot of credit for pulling the plug on it. And basically, and this is a point that Kaplan makes in the book, I think is quite correct. If you look at the new sort of, you know, national defense strategy, it's basically sort of saying, we're not going to do this again.
Right.
We're not going to do this. No. You never want to say never, obviously.
But you know, if pirates are coming out of Somalia, you know what? We're not going to go occupy Somalia.
Right.
We're just going to have to find a different way to you know, to fight piracy there. And you know, same with Yemen, same with other failed states that are problems for us. Well, I guess that's that. Coin will one day be an embarrassing sort of embarrassing chapter in the intellectual history of Marshall.
I mean,
America.
I hope so, right? I mean, I'll just say one last thing before we end up here. I want to say, I mean, to Obama's credit, I mean, I think he's one of the few people in Washington who actually understands the lessons of Iraq, which is that, you know, there are limitations on U.S. power, there's limitations what we can accomplish militarily, and you know, the key is to avoid getting involved in stupid wars. You know, not try to figure out how we can win them, but to avoid fighting them in the first place. And I think, you know, if we leave his presidency 4 years from now with that basic idea, you know, sort of dictating national security policy, I'll be very happy. You know, it was for a long time with the Powell Doctrine, we should avoid stupid wars. And I feel like, you know, he's kind of gotten back to that, and that's hopefully a positive thing comes out of this. But in the end, I think you're right. This coin doctrine, you know, FMV24 is up here on my bookshelf, is going to be gathering dust up there. And I don't think it's going to have much impact on how the military plans its missions in the future.
Yeah, and if there's one thing to take away from Kaplan's book, which I really do think is worth reading, it's that ideas really do matter, and ideas in the wrong people's hands in the Pentagon and in Washington can kill a lot of people. So
yes.
we do actually need to pay attention to these theories that come out of the defense intellectual world and fight the bad ones because they do a lot of damage.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, Michael, we'll take care.
Well, that was a pleasure. And, I hope everyone enjoys the conversation.
All right. Bye.